From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week we'll meet some artists who've gone steampunk, a pianist who can't shake the boogie-woogies, and the diva of Derry. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
Don't miss a word right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, grilled cheese sandwiches, boogie-woogie piano, and modern dance. But first, comedian, musician, and motivational speaker Rick Garrett is a multifaceted man, and he's made a richly textured career along the spectrum of those talents, as contributor Pete Brown recently discovered.
Really, Rick, as long as I've known you, I've always thought of you kind of as this really interesting, well-rounded, kind of the definition of like an entertainer, you know? I mean, I think I know so many people that are musicians. There's so many people that are artists, but you've done things from obviously being in patchwork with your wife, Holly, doing solo things, being kind of an historic interpreter sort of role from time to time, and now comedy, and comedy's been around for a while
as well. It has been.
So, I mean, I think of you in this really interesting, almost like old school way when an entertainer was an entertainer, you know? They were dancing, they were singing, and they were, you know, doing all these different things. Not that you dance. Do you dance?
I do not dance.
All right, fair enough.
And I was raised a Baptist, and that was strictly forbidden.
Well, and that's really interesting, too, because we were talking about that earlier.
Right.
You know, and I'm curious, how did that fuel or evolve into all the creative things you're doing today? Because originally, that was sort of frowned upon. Is that right?
It was. You know, anything that smacked of entertainment, anything that brought attention to yourself was certainly frowned upon. It was forbidden. So I was raised, I would spend my early years in East Tennessee in a very isolated little community. Really knew nothing of the outside world. And that even went into my high school and teenage years because I was raised in a very small town. My dad got out of the coal mines and moved to Indiana, which was kind of the hillbilly's dream.
Sure.
I say that with respect, you know, but to get out of the mines and get a good factory job up here was what they all strive for.
Okay.
So grew up in a very, Cowan is a town of 200 people. So, you know, very isolated, didn't know much about the outside world. And when I finally got out of high school, moved away a little bit, I realized there was a whole big world out there that I didn't know anything about. And it was fascinating. There was a feeling of culture shock.
It
was almost like moving to another country. All these things were completely foreign to me. And I just absolutely fell in love with it. And as I got older and was able to kind of examine why I fell in love with it, I believe it's because I saw this as a way to make the world a better place. You know, through comedy, through some of the things I do, I really do try to make the world a better place. Laughter has benefits, you know, it lowers your blood pressure, it makes us more healthy. I hesitate to use this word, but in some ways it is almost a ministry.
Yeah, I could agree with that. It's very interesting. Well, and how many years would you say you've been doing comedy?
Just into my sixth year.
Okay, so this is really the newer edge of the entertaining things that you're doing.
It is.
I mean, really, even after 6 years. How do you start getting into comedy as somebody who really wasn't exposed to it earlier?
So I saw an ad in the paper for a comedy contest in Indianapolis, and I told Holly, my wife, that I wanted to enter. You had to write 5 minutes of original material enter this contest. So we went, I entered, had never been on the comedy stage before, and it was terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And once I looked back on that, as a musician for 40-plus years, every time I was on stage, there was something between me and the audience, a guitar, a piano, you know, some kind of instrument. So there was some kind of barrier between me and the audience, all psychological. But suddenly I'm up there with nothing but me and my thoughts.
Yeah.
But first time out, I ended up winning the contest.
Oh, wow.
a TV appearance out of that and just kind of went from there.
And obviously coming up, we've got Straight Outta Cowan, which
yes.
is hilarious. I love the NWA reference. I'm assuming a lot of the people who see it get it.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, what inspired that?
You know, comedy is folk that aren't comedians may not realize this, but basically comedians are telling their life story.
Hmm.
You know, they find the funny in things that happen to them every day.
Sure.
And so this is kind of my life story of growing up in a very isolated community in Tennessee and then a very small town in Indiana. And then just discovering this whole wide world of experiences and people and music and food that's out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, although I hope people laugh a lot, even more than that, I hope that they are motivated to kind of go out, take a chance, try a new food, try a new experience, try something they've always wanted to do.
Yeah.
I do a fair amount of motivational speaking for corporations and so on and so forth. And one of my messages is that you're never too old to try something new.
Yeah.
You know, I was 55 when I stepped on the comedy stage for the first time. That's ancient in the years of in comedians' age.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But it has just been an amazing journey.
Well, and I'm guessing there's a lot of people who have been through similar paths to you, you know?
There are.
Yeah, and so I'm sure you'll reach out to people like that are going to get it, you know, if they're allowed to listen to comedy. That
yeah.
So we have this coming up in August. That's just a couple weeks out.
It is.
And you're going to be actually doing this at Chaos Company Theater, which is new to me. Can you talk a little bit about this venue?
Sure. It's in the Brookside neighborhood on the near east side of Indianapolis, kind of where Brookside, Irvington, and three or four other neighborhoods come together. Mm-hmm. The theater has three stages. The large stage, which will hold 80 or so, depending on the stage configuration, where mm-hmm. we're going to be taping. A medium-sized stage that holds 50, and one that holds 25, that they do some one-man shows and so on. It's a professional theater. The actors get paid.
Mm.
Really, really nice place. Great place for intimate shows.
Cool. And it looks like your comedy, A, is appropriate for all audiences, which is also really unique and fantastic.
It is. It is. And, you know, real early in my career, I wanted to be kind of inclusive.
Mm.
And, you know, I love a good blue comedian. Don't get me wrong. But that's just not me.
Yeah, sure. You know? And admission is pay what you wish, but seating is extremely limited at 75. Another interesting thing about this taping is that any of the money that you raise is going to help out another organization, right?
It is. Richard Probst is a local activist, also a film reviewer, pretty well known in the community. Richard actually, you may not know this, Pete, Richard actually introduced my wife and I.
Oh, really?
In a kind of roundabout way.
Small world.
So Richard has been involved in the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence and a number of other charities throughout the years. And Holly and I both had been involved in some of his events but had never met.
Mm.
So I actually met Holly through Richard's MySpace page.
Funny.
So I think we are the last surviving couple still together that actually met on MySpace.
Thinking of other comedians that you enjoy listening to, who are your top recommendations? If folks are listening and they're kind of maybe not that into comedy, but that you've sparked an interest, who do you want to, besides yourself, who do you want to direct them to?
Well, there are a few, and I tend to be kind of a storyteller. There are some comics that are just punchline after punchline after punchline, but I love developing stories and putting a little tension in there and then having a laugh at the end. As mentioned earlier, Bob Newhart is the absolute master of that. Love Bob Newhart. One that makes a swing through town really often is Haywood Banks. I'm sure you're familiar with Haywood.
Sure.
Not only a fantastic comedian, but an amazing guitarist, amazing musician and songwriter. Dave Dugan is a name that's been around Indianapolis for a long, long time.
Sure.
Dave is probably one of the smartest comics that I've ever worked with. He is just, his comedy is very smart. And then another one that's been around the local area a long time is Dave the King Wilson. And he's another great storytelling comic.
Okay.
He's got stories about people he's met at the 500 or, you know, when he broadcast for the Pacers and good stuff.
Contributor Pete Brown with Rick Garrett. Rick's slogan is, life is too short to laugh quietly. Learn lots more about him by searching for Rick Garrett, 2 R's and 2 T's, on Facebook. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYF Public Radio. Coming up, blue cheese sandwiches were all the rage at the Indiana State Fair a couple of years ago. What's the treat for cheese lovers this August? But first, Eat Drink Indy's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Steve Hall of Tinker Coffee Company.
So tell me a little bit about the origin of Tinker Coffee, how it all came about.
We started officially, the business officially started in November of 2014. Leading up to that, the kind of idea started to germinate around maybe, you know, February of 2014. Jeff and I had the idea to start a coffee roasting business, help kind of develop the coffee scene, coffee culture in town. So it took us a while to find the space, find a roaster, buy coffee, learn how to roast.
That prompts the question, did you know a lot about coffee when you started? Did you have to learn how to roast?
We knew we really enjoyed coffee. We knew we liked drinking it a lot. Jeff knew more about specialty coffee through his travels with work. He had, you know, seen coffee cultures in other towns. And I liked to drink red ice, so just black coffee and shot of espresso. That was kind of the biggest thing that I always, you know, thought of when coffee was brought up. But Jeff certainly knew more about specialty and kind of introduced me to this whole other side of the business. And so, yeah, leading up to it, we had no roasting experience, no coffee buying experience. No, nothing. No cafe experience, certainly. So
you just wanted to do it? You wanted to do it because you were interested in it?
Yeah, exactly. We really liked this beverage, and we thought that it didn't, the culture here just didn't exist like it could. We thought there was potential for someone to come in and really focus on sourcing incredible coffee and roasting it really well. And we kind of, you know, looked at ourselves and thought, if we could teach ourselves how to do this, could we be successful? We both kind of thought, yeah, like, yeah, we can do this. So it was a little bit of just, you know, having the confidence to kind of go out on your own and just diving headfirst into the industry was the biggest challenge for us initially. But
well, what was the reception, first of all, when you first opened?
The reception was good. You know, we always talk about, I was actually talking with someone yesterday about like what was our first account. And I think we kind of benefited from coming up around the same time Milktooth came up. You know, we kind of both started around the same time. And we were able and fortunate enough to have some friends at the restaurant that helped us get on the menu. And that has really, I think, helped our profile. So that was kind of like the origins, is we first had to learn how to roast, learn how to buy, and then get that coffee to a point where we felt comfortable bringing it out and putting it in front of people. So yeah, as I said, that kind of coincided with the start of Milktooth, and then things kind of cascaded from there a little bit. We just kept roasting really good coffee, kept taking a ton of time to source. That's, you know, one of the most important things, and then just roast really well and hit the pavement and get the coffee in front of people.
Now, how do you do that? How do you get your coffee in front of people?
A lot of it was, you know, my background, while not in coffee, was in wine. And I sold wine in Boston and Chicago. So part of it was just being comfortable talking to people about this product that they might have never tried before. But with that said, I wouldn't say we were terribly aggressive, you know, pushing coffee everywhere we could. We kind of took a more measured approach and, you know, had a few accounts and kind of helped, you know, scale a little bit more slowly. And we knew we needed to focus on the educational side. So the cupping classes have kind of always been a big thing for us to educate the public.
Now, tell me a little bit about the cupping classes, because that's very interesting. I sat in on one time, and so this is kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, I think you were probably one of the first ones we ever did, really. That was fun. It's, you know, cupping is the way that coffee is evaluated in competition, at origin, throughout the world, because it standardizes the process by which coffee is enjoyed. You know, if you brew a cup at home, there's a million factors that can affect the taste. And there's no like standard brewing method, you know, I mean, sometimes there are, but anyway, it just levels the playing field. So everyone kind of experiences the coffee in the same way. So we knew that that was going to be a big thing to just introduce people to what the flavor profiles of specialty coffee could be, you know, understand how is this different from Folgers? Why is it more expensive than whatever you're buying? And that's been a fun way to do that. And there's been a huge interest in just learning about coffee from the public. I mean, we continue to be sold out kind of months in advance, and it's just a lot of fun for us to have that experience and share that experience with people.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and coming up, we dare you not to tap your feet at the Bloomington Boogie Woogie Piano Festival. But right now, Shelby Street's Acceleration Gallery is about to be the primo destination for fans of steampunk and fantasy. The gallery's new show is called Mad Scientists, and I invited artists Gary Lynn, Casey May, and J.D. Bills to talk about how they get into a steampunk and fantasy mindset.
How'd you come up with the theme of this show? I'm not sure which of you to look at. Gary, I'm looking to you.
Yes, it was our curator, Amy Ward, kind of came up with it. It was something that I had been wanting to do since I opened the gallery, because I'm a welder and a fabricator, and I enjoy creating steampunk-type art.
Okay.
So that's kind of where it came from.
Why?
It just kind of fits my style of creating, I think. It's with the metal work, it's easy to come up with things that relate to steampunk. And I like old mechanisms and mechanical things. It's
like
kind of been my life.
Like to tinker.
Like to tinker,
yeah. Okay. Yep. And Casey, how did this come to you as something you'd like to participate in?
It actually worked out pretty well because I do a lot of fantasy illustration. I've always been a fan of dragons and monsters and things like that, and so it was right up my alley as far as the fantasy art goes.
Pen and ink, or what medium?
I work a lot digitally. I work with Corel Painter and a tablet. I do also do traditional art as well, though.
Okay.
But mainly digital.
Okay. And JD?
I found out about the show through Amy Ward. She's a curator there at the Acceleration Art and Photography Gallery, and she invited me to come and show my work, and I have some interest in the fantasy and steampunk genre, so I'm going to take every advantage of that and present some work there.
And what's your window into that whole steampunk and fantasy? Do you go to steampunk events? Or
Not necessarily, but I do visit like the Gen Cons and the Pop Cons that we have here in Indianapolis, and I have an interest in some of the older movies and music that are related, 80s music and movies that are kind of have that fantasy genre relation.
Where do you, now I toss this out to each of you, where do you start when you're doing a show like this? Do you look through existing work and say, ooh, this kind of fits the idea of the show, or do you just start with a blank slate, or does it depend on the show?
Kind of depends on the show. For me personally, it's a little bit of both. I do have a lot of pre-existing work that I just do as I go. I work as a freelance artist, so I have a lot of time to work on art, luckily. And then, so I pick pieces that I think will fit well within the show, and then I might also create new pieces. Just kind of depends on how much forewarning I have.
Quick, there's a show next week.
That's happened before.
I'm sure. Gary, what do you do? Do you look through existing inventory, or do you just start fresh?
Well, I start fresh. I have a lot of ideas in my head that sometimes I remember them, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I write them down and come up with something later in that aspect. But it depends on the show, too. Some things just come natural, and I just pop them out. And sometimes I have to do maybe a little research and get my head into it. So.
JD?
A little bit of what these guys are saying, too. I do have a lot of pre-existing work that I'll go back and try and relate and see if I can fit that into the show. But at the same time, I'll go in and brainstorm. I'll do some research and look for things that are interesting in that particular genre, this case, the fantasy genre. And I'll come up with some plans or some designs, and then I'll paint. I typically am an acrylic painter, and I'll paint onto canvas or board or walls, whatever the case may be for that situation.
Tell me about the most unusual piece you have in hand so far for this exhibition.
Right now, I'm working on something. It's kind of funny. It's a little play on words painting. I took the idea of steampunk, this genre that we're talking about, and a punk rocker, and I have this steampunk rocker.
Okay, oh, fun!
It's kind of a fun painting, and it's kind of your punk rocker, what you would think of, your stereotypical, with the mohawk and the leather jacket, and then I gave it kind of the steampunk features. And it's kind of robotic and has a lot of metallic features to it.
Oh, I can't wait to hear the music that comes out of that painting.
Absolutely. It's going to be themed. It's going to have a theme song and everything.
Really?
Oh, yeah. you're going to have to come check it out. The show's August 4th.
Right, right. Yeah. Gary, most unusual piece you, and as we're having this conversation, you still have some time, but so far, most unusual piece.
The one that I like the best so far is, I call it the Bust of Bolts. It's a bunch of bolts that I collected off of a couple of jobs that came off of shipping containers, and I shaped them into a bust and welded them together. So it's like 300 and some bolts that are all configured into a woman's bust.
Whoa.
So it's very interesting.
Wow. Okay.
I can't wait to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. And Casey, most unusual piece so far?
I'm actually showcasing some of my, I did a series of fantasy monsters that are already existing.
Now, may I ask?
Sure.
Are there monsters that aren't from fantasy?
Well, I mean, sure.
Okay. I mean, well, just
people
curious.
Can be pretty monsters.
Oh, okay. Just curious. We have to define our terms here.
But mine are all critters, but mine are a lot of like Greek mythology creatures, but they're my twist on them. So they're not your, I guess, generic idea of what they would be. So mine are kind of mutant looking and strange, but yeah, I'm pretty excited about it.
Gary Lynn, Casey May, and J.D. Bills. You can see their work and that of a number of other artists in the Mad Scientist Show opening Friday, August 4th at Acceleration Gallery. That's at 1336 Shelby Street. To learn more, search for Acceleration Gallery on Facebook. The Indiana State Fair opens in just a few days, so we wanted to give you a sneak peek at the menu at the always popular American Dairy Association of Indiana's Dairy Bar. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer is here with information on this year's pieces of edible art. Yum!
I had the chance to get the inside scoop, so to speak, on that, on the milkshake flavor, of course, and the grilled cheese sandwich. I talked with Michelle Plummer. She is the food service and retail manager for the American Dairy Association of Indiana. She's kind of their diva of dairy, you could say, especially when it comes to running the dairy bar at the state fair, both leading up to the event and during the run of the fair. The American Dairy Association of Indiana held its first grilled cheese contest last year at the state fair to determine which sandwich will be served this year. Michelle Plummer says the winning concoction comes from a northern Indiana dairy farmer.
The actual winner is a dairy farmer in northern Indiana named Andrew Kienert, and he came up with this mousetrap, and it is Texas toast with Havarti, cheddar, and Colby on it, and it is so cheesy and so delicious.
This year's featured milkshake is root beer float.
The idea was to bring the illusion of that root beer float and the flavor all together. So it's just a milkshake, so it's not going to look like a float, but it is going to have the flavor and the smell of root beer and taste like our great shakes that we're known for.
The theme of the 2017 State Fair is the wonderful world of food, but products served at the dairy bar are 100% Hoosier.
Our dairy that provides the ice cream, the milk, the shake mix, all of that is Prairie Farms. They're right up in Anderson. Our cheesemaker is Dutch Case House, which is right in Middlebury.
The people that staff the dairy bar are local, too.
It's bands, it's FFA, it's 4-H, it's just a group that's trying to earn some extra money. And many of those groups have been with us for decades. And they come, they eat, they have a good time. They wait on our customers with great joy and enthusiasm. We might hear a cheer of their school now and then. But it's all to make the fair fun.
And a product that is worth the wait.
We understand the lines are long. We understand that we can only go so far. But we have 10 windows, which is more than anybody else at the state fair. And people are still willing to wait. With a little bit of patience, you're going to get a good product. And we try to just make it a way of honoring our dairy farmers. We have 1,100 of them in the state with over 174,000 cows producing that great dairy product every day.
Meanwhile, the quest for the 2018 grilled cheese sandwich is underway.
We're looking for a nice bread, nice cheese ratio. If you want to add some additives, like maybe a salsa or mustard or a topping, by all means. If you add meat, that's fine. You're not going to be dinged on that, but we want it mostly dairy and a little bit of everything else.
During the month of June, the Dairy Folks actually ran an online recipe contest, and now they have selected 8 finalists who will compete in a tasting competition at the State Fair on August the 12th, and that's where they're going to announce next year's Big Cheese winner, and that will be the sandwich that will be featured at the 2018 fair.
Fantastic. And a reminder that the wonderful world of food is the theme of this year's Indiana State Fair. Opens August 4th, runs through August 20th. Yum.
Yum, yum, yum.
Sign us up. I think we're ready.
We know where we're going to be for the next couple of weeks.
That's exactly right. But you know what? We have some other things that you can go out and do with or without grilled cheese on our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
What do you have?
Well, speaking of the State Fair, WFYI is actually going to be there with a stage this year. And we are going to be doing some special programming on specific days. On August the 5th, it's going to be all about the new EvaCore, the documentary that is coming up, and the Candles Holocaust Museum. They are going to be on the stage with their exhibits all day long. It's going to be a very interesting and enlightening day for everybody of all ages. And EvaCore is actually going to be on stage at 6 o'clock that night speaking as well. That's on August the 5th. August the 6th is the WFYI PBS Kids Day. We've got the Splash and Bubbles. We've got Outrageous with Nate Heck. We've got Mr. Daniel with the sing-along. So that's all day long on the WFYI stage, which is conveniently located right next to the Dairy Bar. So you're not going to be able to miss it. And then on the week of August the 10th, that's a Thursday, we have a wide variety of programs. In the morning, the Da Vinci Pursuit, they're all about science and art. They're going to be there. And in the afternoon, we have some of our small studio session guests, Brett Wiskons, Sarah Grain, and the Billions of Stars. And then on August the 14th, the Indie Shakes Theater Group are going to be doing some Shakespeare in the morning. And then the Indie Jazz Festival, we have some of their jazz musicians playing on the stage during the afternoon and the evening, including Charlie Ballantyne, Native Son, Pavel and Direct Connect, their Latin jazz, and the Rob Dixon Trio is going to wrap everything up at 7 o'clock on the 14th. So another reason to go to the State Fair, please stop by and see us at the WFYI stage while you're out there in line for your grilled cheese and your milkshake.
Or you might bring one of us a grilled cheese sandwich because you're going to be there and so am I.
We'll all be there.
We'll all be there. It's what all the cool kids are doing. Hey, happy centennial to the carousel at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. All of the animals on the carousel, with the exception of just one horse, were originally animals recovered from the Broad River Amusement Park. So they have a nice, long Indianapolis history. There are 42 handcrafted animals, including, I believe, 18 of them jump. So there you go. So if you are thinking about, oh, what can I do with my kids to celebrate because they're going back to school, you might go to the Children's Museum. And even if they think they're too big, encourage them to ride on the Denzel Carousel.
Coming up at the at Connor Prairie, this is a continuing series. It's a play all about Frederick Douglass. It's called More Light, Douglass Returns, and it's a joint production with the Asante Children's Theater and Connor Prairie. It was written by Celeste Williams and inspired by the historic return to Indiana by Frederick Douglass back in 1880. And this play has been going on throughout the month of July, and you'll be able to see it in August, Saturday, August the 5th, from 3 to 4:30, and Sunday, August the 6th, from 7 to 8:30 in the Lilly Theater.
The Carmel Clay Public Library is hosting the 2017 Carmel Film Forum on Friday, August 4th, and Saturday, August 5th. It's a free, fun, educational event crowned by film screenings and Q&As with successful Hollywood filmmakers. Now, all of the events are free, but you need to register, and to do that, you go to MoriartyMedia.com, Moriarty like the villain in the Sherlock Holmes stories, MoriartyMedia.com, or you can register in person at the Carmel Clay Public Library AV Desk at 55 4th Avenue in Carmel, Indiana.
And another accolade for the Great American Songbook Foundation Museum up there in Carmel at the Palladium, the Center for the Performing Arts. They have now been named a Grammy Museum Cultural Affiliate, which means they are going to be able to show the same exhibits here in Indianapolis that the LA-based Grammy Museum shows. And there are only about 5 other museums around the world that have access to some of these incredible exhibits. There will be programs for students and it's going to be a wonderful thing coming. So keep your eyes peeled to the Center for the Performing Arts. Check their website, thecenterpresents.org, as new exhibits come from the Grammy Museum right here to Indianapolis. And if you need other things to do, you can find them by looking up the local arts events guide at theindiearts.org/guide. That's brought to you by the Arts Council of Indianapolis. Or you can join us again next week when we take a look at our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Still to come, Garçon, piano, 8 to the bar. But first, Gregory Hancock had a vision of how to integrate storytelling, modern dance, inventive lighting, colorful costumes, and creative sets into an art form that transcends traditional dance. Now, that was 20 years ago, and Gregory Hancock Dance Theater is still going strong as they launch their anniversary season. I invited Gregory and Board Chair Ivy Hazeltine to tell us a bit about the new season and about what inspires them. Gregory, how'd you get to 20 years already? That was fast.
Oh, my gosh. It was very fast. 20 seasons. I can't believe it.
What, when you were starting this company, did you have a vision? I'm not asking about a written business plan, but kind of a vision of how you would like the company, the mission, to evolve over the years, or have you taken it in smaller steps than that?
No, I think I had a mission to begin with, a vision of the company and where it would go, and it's pretty much stayed on track. I mean, there's always challenges with running a not-for-profit. But,
what? I'm shocked to hear you say that.
Yes. But, you know, I've stayed true to my vision and the mission of the company, and here we are at 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Congratulations. And you're starting the season with a celebration.
We are. Kind of a celebration concert of the past 20 years. I'm selecting some of my favorites, maybe some audience favorites, hopefully, a new work as well. So hopefully a very exciting program to kick off the season.
It's a good start. Ivy, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit because you shared before we turned the microphones on that your daughter, who is now an adult, danced with Gregory's company. Danced with Gregory years ago. How would you describe the particular niche of this dance company?
Well, GHDT is unique. Gregory is the sole choreographer and artistic director for the company. And we really try to pursue all of his goals and the company mission each and every concert. Gregory has his own unique style. It is a contemporary modern ballet combination as far as the dancing is concerned, but he's an incredible storyteller, and each one of his pieces has a true meaning. It is very thought-provoking, and it is very entertaining, so the audience members are thrilled with each and every performance.
Gregory, good job choosing a board chair.
I know,
she
that
gets
was great,
you.
Wasn't it? Very good.
So I'd like you to expand on what you just said about the difference between setting choreography on a company and telling a story with that choreography.
Yeah, I'm always drawn to stories. For me, the narrative begins with that story, developing characters, using themes of music for a character, finding, I don't know, just that perfect dance and choreography for that character too. That's always a challenge for me, but I love that challenge, and I just always have kind of worked that way with my pieces.
Which, what you just said, suggests to me that the company is different every time you have a new dancer or lose a dancer.
It is. I think that companies are always evolving, and sometimes you choreograph for who you have at the time, mm-hmm. how they inspire you, how they're a muse for you, certain dancers. And just, finding the best movement for that particular dancer. I really love working that way.
You've had a series of amazing trips that have inspired you? And I don't know which comes first, the desire to set music and themes and stories of, say, Mexico or India or Russia on a company, or whether the trip comes first. But are you highlighting any travels this season?
Well, I think there's always that element of world music in our programming, ethnic dance styles that are combined. February, we have a program called Simcha, which is kind of a celebration of Jewish heritage and Jewish music and culture.
What is Simcha? Remind us.
Simcha means celebration. Okay. So that's why I chose it for this 20th season, another uh-huh. celebration in the middle of the season there. So, yeah, travel, you know, is so important for me. I think there's such this whole world of music and culture and art and theater that sometimes we don't know about. We get trapped in our backyards too often. So for me, I really need to travel. It's just absolutely vital for me. And and I hopefully bring that back, bring some essence of my experiences back to fuse into my choreography.
Ivy, I don't know if you've been working with Gregory long enough to answer this, but can you tell when it's time to push him and say, go pack a suitcase and get out of here?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I know that exact moment. I think he's such a creative individual. I think he does draw from all of his experiences and especially travel. I think that he does get revitalized maybe as he makes his trip to other countries and, you know, across the United States, wherever it may be. And there's always a tidbit that he brings back that inspires for the next piece, I'm sure. It's in there somewhere.
Gregory Hancock Dance Theater's founder and artistic director, Gregory Hancock, and board chair, Ivy Hazeltine. You can learn all about their season, including a couple of performances featuring alumni of the company, at GregoryHancockDanceTheater.org. You know how sometimes people say, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it? You might feel that way about boogie-woogie music. Its distinctive rhythm makes its presence felt to lots of people who might have trouble saying exactly what it is. But if you've ever found yourself tapping your feet when listening to jazz or blues, there's probably some boogie-woogie technique creeping into your ears. Bloomington's Craig Brenner wants you to celebrate this distinctive music, and he's organized the third annual Bloomington Boogie-Woogie Piano Festival coming up August 13th and 14th. I called Craig to get the notes. Do you remember the first time you ever heard boogie-woogie piano or any instrumentation?
Well, I do remember when I was a young boy that my mother had a player piano in our house, and although I don't believe any of the piano rolls were boogie-woogie, I found in the bench a book, I think it was called How to Play Boogie-Woogie Piano, which had some interesting left-hand patterns and some right-hand figures to go with it. So I was introduced to that probably when I was around 6 or 7, right before I started taking piano lessons as a child.
That's fun. and forgive my ignorance, but is boogie-woogie piano a child of the blues or jazz, or where did it start?
Well, I have done a little bit of research into it, and I think that it's more akin to early blues as it was played by piano players back in the early part of the 20th century. And it was often used to entertain groups of people who would gather in large, sometimes known as barrel houses. The piano player could play a dance rhythm, and it's called boogie-woogie because people would dance to it. And it's got a pretty distinct pattern in that the left hand usually plays on every eighth note of a bar. So sometimes it's known as eight to the bar music.
Yeah.
In that the left hand's going one and two and three and four and on each of those beats, a note. And it's usually a single note or sometimes a double note. It depends on which particular pattern the left hand is playing. And then the right hand is free to improvise above and play often repeated patterns.
Did you You referenced starting piano lessons fairly early. Did your first piano teacher embrace your enthusiasm for this, or did you have to kind of circle back and do more traditional repertoire for a few years before you could fully indulge yourself?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't taught boogie woogie. My piano teachers throughout my life pretty much didn't emphasize it, and I had a pretty traditional upbringing in terms of playing traditional classical literature and etudes and Hannon exercises and things like that. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I actually remembered or came back to boogie woogie by way of going to the New Orleans Jazz Festival a number of times and hearing some really spectacular blues-based piano players down there who weren't exactly boogie-woogie players, because the rhythms that pianists put to the blues down in New Orleans were not the same ones that were recorded or performed in Chicago or on the East Coast or other Midwestern towns, because they had different, more Latin-based rhythms, as sometimes you can listen to some early Jelly Roll Morton and hear something that he called the Latin sound in his left hand and in his rhythmic patterns. So I really became sort of like, not exactly a disciple, but I played a lot of Professor Longhair tunes earlier in my career. And then I realized that some of his tunes were based on earlier boogie-woogie tunes, but they were using that rhythmic displacement that I mentioned, that sort of Latin-based in the left hand. So I sort of came to boogie-woogie, you know, in a roundabout way as an adult.
That seems like the best way to come to it.
Right.
And so it's one thing to discover something that you enjoy playing and exploring, because clearly, based on what you've just said, and there are different schools, kind of like there's East Coast Swing, West Coast Swing, there's different kinds of boogie-woogie. It's a big step to start a festival, and there can't be that many boogie-woogie piano festivals in the country, right?
Well, there are not that many that are dedicated to strictly blues and boogie-woogie piano. The closest one to Bloomington is the one that takes place in Cincinnati, which is having its 25th anniversary this year. The Cincy Blues Fest started an all-piano blues and boogie-woogie stage 25 years ago. And all day on the Saturday of the Blues Fest, they have piano players playing starting this year at about 4 o'clock until around close to midnight. So there aren't that many in the United States that focus strictly on blues and boogie-woogie piano. But in 2014, my wife Lori and I went to France, where I played at the festival in La Rocabrue, and saw what was possible. And that is a multi-day festival that consisted of music for 4 days and a swing dance camp that started earlier in the week. So that by the time the musicians started playing on Thursday nights, there were people who knew how to do all kinds of dance moves because they had been participating in dance workshops every day. And when we came back, I decided that I would try and start something similar here in Bloomington, which the first one took place in 2015. But it was basically based on those two ideas, the Cincinnati Blues Fest piano stage and the La Rocabrue Festival that we experienced in 2014.
Good for you. We're proud of you. We can do it here. I love
it. It was quite an undertaking, but there were a lot of sympathetic organizations, and especially organizations that offered grants that enabled us to launch the festival.
Right, right. You've got a lot of great supporters and partners, and a lot of the festival is free. And in addition to ticketed concerts featuring some top-notch talent. And then tell me about, you have some workshops for students, right?
Yes, we're really excited about the fact that we've increased our educational opportunities this year. We have two free concerts that will take place at Templeton and Fairview Elementary Schools in Bloomington, and that's the day after the public festival. So on Monday, August 14th, the concerts take place at those two schools, followed at each school by free blues and boogie-woogie piano workshops that will take place starting around 3:45 p.m. at those two schools. And we also have some free tickets that we give so that students and their families can attend some of the ticketed concerts at the Ivy Tech Waldron on Sunday, August 13th, as a result of some of the grants that we got.
That's great because, among other things, you're raising the next generation, so there'll be somebody to inherit your festival way down the road.
Well, I hope it'll continue that long.
Craig Brenner is the founder of Bloomington's Boogie Woogie Piano Festival, coming up August 13th and 14th. It gives you a chance to listen and dance to acclaimed blues and boogie woogie pianists from around the world. Public performances take place on August 13th, and educational activities take place in several public schools on August 14th. There are lots of free events and a screening of the documentary I Am the Blues. That movie takes you on a musical journey through the swamps of the Louisiana Bayou, juke joints of the Mississippi Delta, and moonshine-soaked barbecues in the North Mississippi Hill Country. BloomingtonBoogies.org is the source of all the details. BloomingtonBoogies.org. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here today with Samite, a Ugandan musician living in the United States, an incredible musician with an incredible catalog of work. And Samite, I just asked you about this, but you play a variety of East African instruments. You play the litungu. Mm-hmm. What else? Yeah, tell us.
I play the litungu, I play kalimba, I play madinda, which is like a xylophone. And the litungu is a seven-string harp. And I play a lot of flutes, and I sing.
And write amazing songs and
Thank
compositions.
You.
And
yes.
Folks can check out all your music online at samite.com. And today you're going to share with us five songs or five artists that you're a fan of, things that have influenced your work or things that you listen to for enjoyment. What's your first song for us?
I think I'll say the first musician, okay?
Okay.
Is Oliver Mutkutsi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think there's any song he's done that I don't like. I think if you just picked out any song from Oliver Mutkutsi, it would be just perfect.
I'm a huge fan of his, and I just had Thomas Mapfumo on my show, and they're kind of like rivals coming up in Zimbabwe, right?
Yeah.
They both had popular bands.
Yeah, yes. He's incredible. Yeah. He's an amazing, and I just recently learned, I met him, and when they introduced us, he said, "No, I love your music. I have it in my car." I was like, "No kidding."
Oh, wow.
So it was really nice to know that.
Your second artist, of course.
My second artist is Fatou Diawara.
Oh, yeah.
You know that?
Oh, yeah.
She's incredible.
Yeah.
She's beautiful. That
From Mali, right?
Yeah. Lahi, 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 mamma, that I saw, lahi, kone, bina, kumasa. Nebe, sara, la, muzohula, hatunu, ya, muzohula, kula, mogelema. Ibe kono ta segena kide molo segena kika no la mo abada kada gala mola ibo di la mola kika no to no dum abada sa and of course Salif Keita.
Oh yeah,
yeah, I like the fact that he's free to use electronics. Like, music is full of electronics and you don't think of the electronics. You hear music, you don't hear electronics when you hear his music. Even there, all these horns and keyboards and synthesizers, he's able to take music and electronics and make it sound African. And of course, Hugh Masekela.
Jew Masekela?
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine. And,
oh, wow.
He and I have been friends for a while, and I like his music very much.
In what period of his work do you prefer? Like the early stuff or the funk stuff from the 70s?
Well,
or?
Stuff from, that when he wrote that, Bring Back Nelson Mandela, Bring Back. Stimela, Sihambanga Malale, Sivele, Dalapu, Baye.
And your final artist that you're going to share with us today is?
Some people pronounce it Asa or
from Nigeria.
Yeah,
Asia.
She is amazing.
Great songwriter, right?
Yeah, she's a great songwriter, and I think the music is recorded really, really well. There is fire on the mountain. And nobody seems to be on the run. Oh, there is fire on the mountain top, and no one is running. So those are some of the albums that I repeat again and again when I'm ready to listen to other people's music.
Yeah, no wonder your music is so good, because you're listening to these masters.
Great musicians. Yeah. These are real masters, yes.
And Semite, your new album is called Another Side of Me. And Semite.com is where folks can hear all your music. It's Samite.com.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Semite, for playing
these
great songs. Appreciate it.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Pete Brown and Jill Dittmeyer. You can hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, motorcycles at the Indiana History Center, an NEA grant that will invigorate a community, and things with wings at the IMA. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.